What's day-to-day for Tom Fitzgerald like now? Everyone's schedule is, over the past couple of weeks has been turned upside down. I know there's no such thing as normal right now, but what is a day like for the New Jersey Devils general manager?
Well, you're right about the normal quote. We're all getting into the new normal right now as the days and weeks obviously, go by. For me personally, we as an organization are in constant communication as an entire company, and we have daily calls in the morning, just updates from the hockey side, the business side, to even the basketball side and the business ops for them, which is nice. You wake up, you have these calls, and then I'll have daily calls with my own staff, whether it's, I break it down into groups, whether it's my farm team, my NHL coaches, my NHL staff, my hockey ops department, first floor we call it, amateur scouts, pro scouts. And as the weeks and days come and go, I'll kind of adjust the schedule during the week. Might not talk to people tomorrow, but definitely Monday, Tuesday, Monday, Wednesday. So we're in constant communication. The thing I stress with our group is take advantage of this time. Get off your plate that you may have done something later in the spring, early summer. Like, just get to it. We've got time on our hands. So just different projects as well, personally. And then working closely with our amateur staff and our pro staff on, as everybody else is probably doing, video scouting and giving them direction on, players to watch, and from the amateur side, trying to help with building our draft list. So we're busy. I'm constantly, as everyone else in our industry is like, probably, you're chewing up hours and hours of your day on the phone. So the new norm is what it is, and it's actually getting adjusted to it.
Fitzy, we want to talk about your path. We've been talking to coaches and GMs about how they got to be a general manager. But before we do that, I remember your draft year. I came and watched you play. They put on, USA Hockey put on a showcase. I think it was at Providence College, actually. And you were the best player on the ice. And you went from a second rounder to a first rounder on everyone's list with two games. Do you remember that?
I do. That was, if I recall, Brian, it wasn't a USA Hockey. It was a Hockey Night in Boston tournament that was incredible for New England kids with exposure to people like yourself and all managers. It was crazy to play in those arenas and having, I called them the top coach back then, the overcoach. All the general managers were there watching. And, yeah, that's the rumor. That those couple of games during that spring of 86 propelled me into the first round. And so be it. But, to answer your question, I guess, how did I get to this spot? As I played a long time.
Yeah, 17 years.
I always felt I was a student of the game. I had to make adjustments as each year ticked by on, I don't want to say how to survive, but just how to, I guess, reprogram myself as a player. Because we all come in as highly touted scoring type players, and we all know how hard it is to produce at the National Hockey level. So I was lucky because of the mentorship that I received with coaches like Al Arbor, Jimmy Roberts in the American Hockey League. I had Butch Goring for a little bit in the American Hockey League, not very long. And then getting coaches like Roger Nielsen and Pat Quinn. Even Doug McClain was very helpful in my career. But early on in the Islander days, I was you could see where I was trending to as a player, but it brought value. And that's the one thing that Al Arbor always told me. It brings value. And every team needs players like yourself. So, again, kept playing and ended my career here in Boston, which was great for my family. And I had a great time in Toronto as well, playing there for those 2 years. But obviously thinking ahead to what's life after hockey going to be. I think I always felt coaching was in my blood. But all of a sudden, coming out of my last year, I was preparing for life after hockey, and I prepared to do television with the Boston Bruins on NESN, college hockey, analyzing games. That was a lot of fun. And I also had a volunteer coaching gig at UMass Lowell that showed, you know, I was on the ice with the players and gave me a kickstart to that. But it wasn't until the next year. Actually, most importantly, O'Brien, was the part that people before me gave me advice. Get back to your family. I mean, I played a long time. I moved around. At this point of my life, I have four boys. I wanted to get them settled somewhere, and Boston was that place. And I gave a year to them, meaning, you know, I helped coach my two older boys. I was on the ice practicing, blah, blah, blah. The following year is when I got a call from Ray Shiro. And that's when player development was actually at his infancy. And we talked for a while, and he asked me my thoughts on it. And just with my background, personality, I have people skills, just being able to communicate with players, coaches, agents, and from there it grew, right? It just it grew to relationship building with all the people I just mentioned, the agents. You know, just it came natural, and got thrusted behind the bench there in 09 in February, and coached the remainder of the year, won a cup as an assistant coach. But I knew right then I wanted to continue down the management path, and development gives you that opportunity to decide. You're gonna hit a fork. And it's either coaching or managing. And I really enjoyed, you know, working with Ray and Jason Botterill and Chuck Fletcher in those early years on team building. And I just found it fascinating to put your stamp on a team. And that's how it went. You know, it just continued to grow that way, grew into doing contracts, grew into, you know, obviously coaching decisions, working hand-in-hand with the coaches, working hand-in-hand with Ray, trade, scouting, you name it. I've done it all. And I'm very proud of that, and I worked hard at it as well. So that's how I got to where I'm at right now.
Yeah, and I've seen you in enough ranks, so I know you've worked at it, because that's certainly how I did it too. I have to get a plug-in for Providence College, and another
boy.
Providence College alum, another Freya.
Yeah.
So you had two interesting facts that people listening might not know. You were twice selected in expansion drafts. Walk us through that real quick.
Well, actually, no, Brian, I wasn't. I was selected for the Florida Panthers expansion draft. Now fast forward to the Predators. I was a free agent, and I had four teams that I was thinking about signing with, and out of the blue, David Poyle talked to my agent about someone else and just happened to ask where I was at and what I was doing. He kind of explained to him, and he just threw out, would he consider expansion again? My wife and I actually were down on Cape Cod with our boys, three boys at the time, and two boys at the time. And, you know, we went for a long walk, and we just had such a great experience in Florida with the people that were there, the culture that was set, the environment, expectations, just the character of what we were in Florida in those early years, and felt, why wouldn't it be the same? And it was, and being the leader of the group too. So, that's how I got to Nashville. And I look back and think, to expand. It's funny, my son Casey, obviously all my boys are home, and 96 finals, Game 4, where we went to triple overtime against Colorado, was on, and they were watching, thinking, oh my God, how bad is this hockey, by the way, they were saying. And two, I didn't know you played for two expansion teams. And I'm like, yeah, I played for two expansion teams. So, yeah, that's how I got to Nashville, obviously because of my experience, great experience in Florida, and felt that if there's anything I can do looking forward and making a mark on my own career, is have a stamp on the culture and the identity of this new up-and-coming organization like the Nashville Predators.
Well, damn Wikipedia. It said you were selected twice. Anyway, you remember in 96 in the finals when we made Beezer change the knob on his stick?
I sure did. And I actually pointed that out to my boys. I said, see the white tape on his knob? Patrick Waugh made a stink about it, and he had to put the white knob because it is a rule which nobody knew.
Yeah, and I had to come down. Know. I came down and tell Doug McClain right before the game started. He went nuts. And I said, look,
tell everyone this story. Give people the background on that one. Then,
so, okay, see, the rules state that you've got to have white tape on the end of your goalie stick so that the video goal judge, well, now, back then the goal judge, wasn't confused by the butt end of the stick entering the back of the net and confusing it with a puck. So it had to be a light color. And Van Beesbrook, Beezer had red tape on his, matching the Florida uniforms. And Pierre Lacroix called me. They deliberately waited till right before the game, not even the warm-up. You guys were going out on the ice, Fitzy. And I had to go down and tell Doug McLean, he's got to put white tape. And Mac went nuts. He's like, what are you doing? Why are you doing this? I'm like, hey, I didn't notice this. I could care less what kind of tape he wears, but it's been called to our attention. I work for the league. I got to fix it. I'll fix it. And it threw Beezer off, and Doug was not right. It was a real good bit of gamesmanship by Colorado, actually.
It was, and then the follow-up on that was, okay, how can we get back at them? And Patrick would always, anytime he would go to the bench for water or go to the locker room, he'd never touch the blue line, red line, never touch the lines. He'd always jump over it, and we tried our hardest to get in front of him so he'd have to skate through it just to screw up with his day.
And then I'll ask one more. I'm kind of monopolizing you here, Fitzy, but you had a great trade deadline, I thought. Tell us about your trade deadline.
Well, thank you. I mean, I'm in a really good situation where I get to do what general managers do as an interim GM, and I'm taking full advantage of that. And, the process started extremely early. I would say the end of January we had our own pro and amateur scouting meetings down in Florida. Got to address the group on some things, change some things, but just kind of, again, nervous, as they tell people all the time. I felt like I was drinking water out of a fire hose. It was just that kind of confusing. But, the calls started to come in early. There were some vultures early that jumped on me about certain things. And you know what? And I appreciated that, actually, with these general managers that called me, because they helped out a lot, by just talking through some things and then throwing around with our group and what teams, and just following up with some calls that Ray had with teams and trying to get to where teams are at. So the process was great. And then you realize at times, like at the end of the day, like we were in this situation to sell for a reason. We underachieved in October. We underachieved in November. We underachieved in December. Coach lost his job. We underachieved in January. Manager lost his job. And we were put in a situation to almost rebuild or pivot our original thoughts from the summer. And it is what it is. So I try to, get the best value for the players that were that had the most interest to other teams out there. I wasn't giving my players away. I believe in the group that's still here and the talent that we have, and we need to build upon that. But at that time, it was, trying to hit on some of these UFAs and Blake Coleman's state that just hit on a player that was well valued throughout the league. So I felt I did that. And I'm sure every year, Brian, you could tell me every year is different. In each case is different too.
I can tell you one thing. It's much more fun being a buyer than it is being a seller.
yeah, it is.
Well, that day will come. Well, you got to get rid of that interim tag and then that day will come.
I appreciate it.
So, Tom, now you find yourself in a situation where you guys have made that transition, moving towards and looking towards the future, towards next season, and pivoting your team into a really strong team. And actually, you guys have been quite good of late before the shutdown. I'm wondering what your thoughts are on the draft now. What are some possible options? What could happen if there's potentially a tournament where 20 teams are involved? Certainly, that would affect the odds. I even saw someone theorize that there could be a tournament held for teams that are potentially in the draft lottery. What are your thoughts on what could happen, what should happen, and basically just what you would like to see happen with the draft now and the lottery odds?
Well, I think the most important thing is getting life back in order here and getting some normalcy back to everybody's life and, get the world back to health. Get the world back healthy. And, with that being said, no one knows what that time frame looks like. As far as hockey's concerned, do I have my own ideas with things? I don't know how these tournaments that are being thrown out there through the media what it would look like. I'm guessing teams like ours would be on the outside looking in. How does that affect the lottery? How does that affect the percentages of that you're given to win a lottery? Would it change if eight extra teams were given the opportunity to be a Cinderella type team? I would hope so. But I really don't. I don't put too much credence into worrying about that. What I'm worried about right now is making sure one, our amateur scouts are on top of all the video that we could possibly do. Again, time is on our hands. So, you know, giving them guidance to go out and make sure we know every single player before we start list building to the criteria that we, you know, that we value. So however this turns out, it will be what it is. But I know the New Jersey Devils will be ultra prepared for whenever we pick in this upcoming draft.
You know, one final thing about your team before we let you go and get on with your day. One thing that I've tried to point out to a lot of people here who may just watch New Jersey every now and then, I tend to watch a lot of Devils games. And the one thing, even though you don't see necessarily the point production there at the end of this season before the pause, I really thought, Tom, that Nico Hischier took his game to another level this season. What did his general manager see this year with Hischier?
Oh, I completely agree with you, and we have yet to see, you know, his ceiling. You know, there's a lot of comparison to a lot of elite players out there. I'm not sure I like doing that. I think it's unfair to a player, but Nico is a unique player. I believe he will win Selke trophies in the future here, and his 200-foot game is it will end up being one of the better centermen in the league. He's a leader. He's a 20-year-old kid. He just turned 21 in January. Mm-hmm. He's a leader already for us, and he's a wonderful person. As good as a hockey player, he's a better person, and he's going to lead this organization for a long, long time. And I think he's up for that leadership. But we'll never thrust anything upon a kid that young this early. Allow him to grow at his pace, but he's growing, and we feel along with Jack. You know, we're going to have two centermen for a long, long time, two really good centermen to build around. So, yeah, no, the New Jersey Devil fan base, I know, is really looking forward to the future with these two kids leading. But Nico, he's a unique person, wonderful guy, great player, great person, comes from a great family. And I know he's up for the challenge to lead this group